Let's go on, Dan, to your patient.
This is a 72-year-old who presented at age 69 with a abnormal CAT scan. Actually, it was pretty asymptomatic. The CAT scan was done incidentally for another reason and was found to have a large left renal mass. It was operated on. It was a T3 clear cell with papillary carcinoma features of the left kidney. At that time, he was resected. He did fine. He's a retired high school teacher, pretty active, both still within the high school and the community, followed by his urologist until he developed left supraclavicular adenopathy, and workup showed that he also had multiple pulmonary nodules. This is back in 2006 when he recurred. So at that time, a biopsy of
the... What was his disease-free interval?
About 2 years.
Two years.
So the biopsy of the node in the left neck showed a tumor that was consistent with his original renal cell, and he was started on interferon. Didn't do very well with interferon. Hated it. Did poorly. So after actually trying to give him even low doses of interferon for about 2.5 months, he elected to stop it. His adenopathy was slowly growing. It wasn't huge. He was pretty asymptomatic with his adenopathy, and he had no pulmonary symptoms. And so at that time, we stopped the interferon. His performance status was still ECOG zero. And we registered him with the Genentech registry program and got him a first dose of Avastin. This is prior to this. I was sort of looking through the charts. This is before we had Sutent, sorafenib. And he had a remarkable response to one dose of Avastin. His supraclavicular nodule was reduced. And his pulmonary nodules, though not dramatically better, did not grow. And he tolerated it fine. I mean, he had no side effects to the single dose of Avastin. And we've had him on Avastin once a month since.
So what is his current situation?
He's asymptomatic. He has measurable disease. I mean, he still has supraclavicular nodes that are palpable. And chest x-rays, actually, we don't even do CAT scans, show that his pulmonary nodules have been stable for actually the last year, 16 months almost.
Any problems with the bevacizumab, hypertension?
No, no. I mean, he's healthy. He walks. He exercises. His blood pressure's not been a problem. He has no arterial risks. He has no DVT risks.
So, Nick, what do you think about this case?
Well, around that time is when, and I don't know exactly when the time was, but I had the same experience. I didn't have sorafenib or sunitinib available, and I also treated two or three patients with single-agent Avastin, waiting for a trial to open in Las Vegas, and had a similar effect. One was a fellow who'd recurred locally in the renal fossa, who'd already been operated on once, so he nephrectomy, local recurrence, regrew, had a spectacular response in the renal fossa recurrence, and was then taken back to surgery at UCLA, where no viable tumor was seen, and the patient remains on single agent Avastin now, as in your case, for about 3 years. And knock on wood, you know, I'm probably going to end up stopping it soon.
So, Bob, can you kind of go through what we know about bevacizumab and renal cell?
It was really the first targeted study that was tried in renal cell carcinoma. And in fact, my understanding is one of the pilot studies of bevacizumab was the initial renal cell carcinoma study. It was a randomized phase 2 trial that was performed at the NCI for patients who had progressed on cytokine treatment. They were randomized to high-dose bevacizumab, lower dose, or placebo. It's published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it showed improvement in progression-free survival for high-dose bevacizumab given at 10 mg per kg every 2 weeks. So that was really the initial data with bevacizumab, and it's certainly the evidence-based medicine for trying bevacizumab in this patient following interferon. Since then, it's been developed in combination with interferon. There has been two large phase 3 trials, one in the United States and one in Europe, of interferon plus Bev versus interferon alone in one or interferon plus placebo that show improvement, rather dramatic improvement in progression-free survival for the two agents. There is a third study that's notable, and that was one that was published by Ron Bukowski following a report from the Haynesworth group of a high level of activity of bevacizumab plus erlotinib that for a short time was used in the community and elsewhere because of the high success rate. But in the industry-sponsored study that Bukowski led, the addition of erlotinib to bevacizumab had no benefit to bevacizumab alone. The other thing that was notable about that study is it's really our only experience with bevacizumab monotherapy in first-line treatment with a median progression-free survival on the order of about 8 to 9 months.
What about responses?
Responses with monotherapy bevacizumab are always low. In the Yang trial, it was about 7%, and the only responses were seen in the high-dose arm. This patient that you present, hard to say whether he's response or stable disease because it looks like he had a good reduction of the supraclavicular node, but depends on how much lung disease he had and whether it shrunk dramatically or not. So it's a little hard for me to say whether he's actually a responder or prolonged stable disease. And similarly, in the first line with bevacizumab, the response rate was about 10%. In combination with interferon, it's been dramatically escalated, more than double. I think it was 25% in the RINI study and about 31% in the Escudier trial. So those data suggest that the combination interferon with bevacizumab seemed to have a synergistic effect in producing a higher response rate.
Where do you think, Nick, right now, just putting cost and reimbursement aside, just looking at risks and benefits, either bevacizumab alone or bevacizumab with interferon sort of fits in the algorithm or would fit in?
Well, when we designed the RINI CLGB trial, I don't know when we did that, 2001, I think, we wanted to do a third arm. We wanted to add bevacizumab alone, but the cost and the time was prohibitive. We couldn't get support for a three-arm trial, so we went with the two-arm trial. And it looks like the two-arm trial, the two is better than one. Unfortunately, we still don't know what bevacizumab alone would do. I would say that evidence-based medicine now suggests in documents that it should be interferon bevacizumab, but you could probably get it reimbursed because you now have two phase three trials which show that it's a tolerable, active, and effective agent. So it should be compendia listed. I don't know if it actually is or not. So from the practicing physician's perspective, an interferon bevacizumab makes sense. There are at least two trials that are designing or designed around trying to displace bevacizumab interferon as a standard combination. And the first one is interferon bevacizumab versus RAD001 or everolimus and bevacizumab. And there is another one, and I'm blocking on it.
It's a phase three of temsirolimus plus bevacizumab versus bevacizumab plus interferon. That's a phase three. The other that Nick mentioned is a large randomized phase two.
Anyone have any questions? Matt?
Yeah, interferon, generally speaking, is not that well tolerated. I think it's fair to say. Why in combination with Avastin would it be, quite honestly? And additionally, in other cancers, Avastin, when mixed with another drug, works much, much better. I'm just wondering if there's other drugs it might work better with. Interferon is not one of our newer drugs. I think that's fair to say.
Well, I'll let Bob comment as well. The role of interferon in renal cell carcinoma is extremely well established. It beats placebo. It has independent single-agent activity. It may even have a survival advantage, although the trials are small. So interferon is a very reasonable standard and has been the standard by which sunitinib has been approved and other agents. So it also has anti-angiogenic properties. It inhibits the fibroblast growth factor pathway, which is one of the angiogenic pathways. So in reality, interferon may be acting on the vascular pathway, the stroma. It also may be acting directly on the kidney cancer cells. So I wouldn't assume that it's a bad combination. It may not be easily tolerated, but it's not an unreasonable combination. And I was reminded of a patient from Reno, Nevada, whose diagnosis was made just as the CLGB trial was started, and the doc didn't have access to the trial and put the patient on interferon Avastin off protocol, and I was sort of aghast, and I said, what are you doing, you know? And the patient had a booming response, virtual complete response, and last time I checked, almost 2.5 years out, the patient's still in remission. So don't downplay this role of interferon bevacizumab. It's an active agent, whether it's as active as sunitinib, we don't have evidence to compare head-to-head.
Gracie?
When these patients, the patient that you mentioned that has a very good response, do you keep on going? until there is progression.
Well, the way the CLGB trial was designed was that you could lower the interferon dose and ultimately you could stop the interferon. So many of these patients stay on maintenance bevacizumab. And the Avorin trial, which was reported at ASCO in sort of a follow-up, also showed that you could reduce the interferon dose, not at the beginning, but after the patients develop toxicity, and apparently maintain the response and the benefit. So if you start off with a standard interferon dose, say 9 million three times a week, 9 or 10 million, you could, with toxicity, dose modify and maintain the Avastin. So I think it's fine to do that, although it's clearly not as convenient for the patient as sunitinib.
What about combinations with bevacizumab other than interferon, particularly the TKIs, Bob, and also the mTOR inhibitors?
We studied bevacizumab in combination with sunitinib in patients with renal cell carcinoma, and we found that there was excessive toxicity for that combination, that we were able to dose, it was a phase one study, and we were able to dose escalate full dose bevacizumab and dose escalate sunitinib up to 50 milligrams in phase one trial. And we found a fairly high level of activity, but the toxicities overlap between the two agents, and the main overlapping toxicity is hypertension and hemorrhage too. So the toxicities that we saw acutely were hemorrhage and hypertension. But what we found is over time, the toxicity was cumulative, and we saw severe toxicities develop. And the one that we described was MAHA, or microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, which occurred in patients associated with CNS findings. It actually resulted in halting a randomized phase two trial of sunitinib plus Bev versus sunitinib plus placebo. And when that trial was halted, we carefully looked at the features of the patients at other centers as well. That was an industry-sponsored study, and they found two patients that were beginning to develop that syndrome at other centers. So that was a clear safety signal that this was a regimen, at least in renal cell cancer, that was not going to be moving forward. Now, the other combinations with Bev, as we mentioned, bevacizumab has been given with temsirolimus and everolimus, both in full doses in phase one trials, and they're moving forward in phase two and phase three, but the combination remains experimental. And bevacizumab has been given with sorafenib in a large phase one trial that shows that the two can be given together, but the doses are really reduced in a major way for both agents in that combination, and there's lots of toxicity. So it looks like moving forward, if there's going to be a combination right now, the leading contenders are bevacizumab and an mTOR inhibitor, but needs to go through phase three trials and really be rigorously evaluated.
Any other questions? John?
Do we have any markers to predict why people would respond to one agent than another, or why they have durable, stable disease?
So that's a very good question, and there's a couple aspects of that question. One is can we predict people who are going to do well with a targeted therapy? There were efforts to look at VHL mutations because we thought that maybe that would predict if a VHL gene is mutated, that would predict response to these targeted therapies. And that really hasn't proven to be the case. We can't base it on VHL mutations. We did a study at our center looking at HIF expression in tumors by Western blot analysis, and it showed that there was good correlation in Western blot analysis between HIF upregulation and response to sunitinib. So those studies were done on fresh tissue, and the challenge now is going to be to see if that can be done on paraffin using immunohistochemistry and whether it's a validated marker. With regard to the mTOR pathway, there's activated parts of the mTOR pathway that are measured in tumor, and there was one small study that was done by Boston that suggested that some of those correlated to response to mTOR, but that really hasn't been shown by others and validated. So I think it would be a really useful strategy if you could define from a tumor standpoint who maybe mTOR inhibitor would be more useful, who TKI would be more useful, following along the line of individualized treatment now that we have multiple agents, but we're not there yet.
Just to expand it a little bit, there are other techniques. They have looked at circulating blood levels of a variety of things, VEGF levels, etc. The higher the VEGF levels are, the worse the prognosis. That has now been confirmed in the target study and I think another study. So you can predict adverse outcome. Likewise, obviously, the non-clear cell histologies have a substantially worse prognosis. And then, of course, you have the staging systems that look at all the other adverse features, liver mets, calcium, and the clinical factors will also be helpful for predicting response. One of the things that Bob Figlin did, for example, was look at S6 phosphokinase as a predictor, and it seems to mark for mTOR, an mTOR-dependent tumor. That's one of the downstream signal transduction factors. But again, small numbers, single institution trials, nothing to hang your hat on yet.
Bob, could you talk a little bit more about the data you presented on HIF? I thought that was really fascinating. It was the first really kind of thing I've seen in this that really looked like it made sense.
Initially, we looked at cell lines, renal cancer cell lines, and we found cell lines that were sensitive and cell lines that were resistant to sunitinib. So experiments were done to look at the HIF status in the RCC cell lines. And
could you go back and explain what HIF is and what the VHL is?
The cardinal feature or the cardinal abnormality in clear cell carcinoma of the kidney that is really the driving factor for these targeted therapies is that the hypoxia-driven gene pathway is abnormal in patients with renal cancer. It was recognized that renal cancer is a highly vascular tumor, felt to be angiogenesis' important role. And what happened is that there was a gene that was discovered called the VHL gene on chromosome 3P that was identified in patients with familial form of kidney cancer called the von Hippel-Lindau syndrome. And that was the gene that's responsible for that syndrome. And in that syndrome, patients develop multiple vascular tumors, with about 40% of patients having active aggressive metastatic renal cell cancer. When sporadic renal cancers were looked at, it was found that, which is much more common, about 60% of patients with sporadic renal cancers had mutations of the VHL gene, and another 20 to 30% had an inactivation by a different way.
And how does this tie into the normal function of the kidney in terms of reacting to hypoxia?
The VHL gene produces a protein, and the protein, the VHL protein, binds to HIF, hypoxia-inducible factor alpha. Under normoxic conditions, when the gene is functioning, VHL protein binds to HIF, and it's broken down through the proteasome system. When there's hypoxia, so that cells need to have more blood vessels and oxygen, then the VHL gene protein cannot bind to HIF when there's not enough oxygen around. And so HIF remains unabated. It's a transcription factor. It goes to the nucleus, and it causes production of growth factors that stimulate blood vessel formation and tumor growth. And the ones that we're most familiar with are VEGF, PDGF. There's some others as well, erythropoietin and CA9. So in renal cell cancer, the way to think about it is it's a tumor that thinks it's hypoxic. Because the VHL gene is mutated, it causes production of a mutated or abnormal protein that can't bind to HIF because its shape is altered. And so HIF just keeps staying in the system and cranking out these growth factors which cause angiogenesis. It's not really clear what the direct effect is on the tumor themselves. There has been some studies that suggest PDGF and PDGF receptor are important in renal cell cancer growth as well.
And can you talk a little bit more about what you presented at ASCO, though?
So in that study, we first looked at sensitive and resistant RCC cell lines. And we found that in those that was sensitive or resistant to sunitinib, in those, the sensitive cell lines had upregulated HIF by Western blot, and the resistant ones did not. Then we did studies, and what we did is we actually took fresh, we had a tumor bank of fresh tumors from patients that were at Memorial treated on clinical trials with sunitinib, and we assessed the HIF expression in their fresh tumors, and we compared it to how they did with sunitinib. So we found out that the patients that had high HIF expression did well with sunitinib therapy, meaning sunitinib impacted on that abnormal pathway, and so they responded progression-free. Where on the other hand, there was a certain proportion, a minority, that didn't express HIF, and they didn't respond to the sunitinib.
Do you think that there might be a clinical assay that would come out of this that would actually guide practice?
I think that's where the direction would go if we can make this or show this in paraffin tumors using immunohistochemistry. And the reason for that is because fresh tumors are often not routinely collected, and they're also difficult to transport from center to center. They're not usually brought by the patients, where paraffin tumors can be transported and are much easier to study.
And is that going to happen, do you think?
I think that there's a high level of interest doing that at our center and at some others, so I think it will happen, but it's probably going to take quite a bit of an effort.
What do we know right now, Nick, about the mechanism of action of these TKIs? And is it on the parenchyma or on the tumor cells or both?
Yeah, I was going to mention that. By rights, once HIF or HIF is overexpressed or continues to be non-downregulated, it produces all these growth factors. It's hundreds and hundreds of factors, GLUT1, PDGF, etc. Those factors may act as autocrine growth factors for the tumor, but even more important, they act as growth factors for the endothelium and for the pericytes. So if the tumor cells produce these growth factors, and they will depend, there's a variation in what HIF produces. Some cells produce only agents that call in endothelial cells. Other tumors call in cells such as pericytes that sheath the endothelial cells. And we've recently had a paper in colon cancer cells showing that a colon cancer cell which only calls in endothelial cells is highly sensitive to anti-angiogenic therapy, whereas a colon cancer which calls in two cells, the pericyte and the endothelial cell, is not as sensitive. And so there's probably infinite variation. But if you think about the tumor cell as the Pied Piper of the stroma and the agent which lures in endothelial cells, all these endothelial cells are normal. And one reason that you may be able to get prolonged responses is that the tumor cell is addicted to that pathway. It's got genetic mutations. And at some point, the tumor becomes resistant and thereby alters other sets of expression. But theoretically, the endothelial cell and the pericytes do not become resistant to Sutent or to the other agents. They continue to respond with downregulation. Although even there, the endothelial cell, pericyte, etc., will find other pathways by which it can survive.
Matt? Is there a rule for measuring the blood levels in a certain patient of the TKIs? Are we sure that the absorption is really stable and good?
There was a study that was done where they assessed pharmacokinetic levels of sunitinib, and they compared the area under the curb by response, and they showed that it correlates, that the patients with the higher area under the curve have a PR to sunitinib, and those with lower area under curves don't. So I think that the takeaway message from that has largely been that if your patients tolerate it, treat it full dose of sunitinib at 50 milligrams rather than given subtherapeutic doses. And it's also brought up a question of whether we could individualize sunitinib treatment based on the blood levels achieved by the patients. And I think that there's a high interest in setting up that kind of a study where you treat with a dose, 50 milligrams or what have you, you assess the area under the curve, and there's a target, and you adjust the dose. But that hasn't occurred.
It also brings up the question of continuous dosing. And there's a debate in the world now of, do you give continuous sunitinib at 37.5, or should you do the 50 for 4 weeks and a two-week rest? And there are certain advantages and disadvantages of both approaches. I think the trial that was just finished was comparing intermittent to continuous. That trial is now finished. It's a randomized phase two, so it will not be definitive. But I can tell you that the continuous sunitinib paper has just been accepted into the Journal of Clinical Oncology, and that trial looks very similar to the trial that Bob did for JAMA, in which it was intermittent versus continuous, same population, interferon pretreated, and it's not clear that they're different at the clinical level. They have slight advantage, 37.5 is probably better tolerated on a long-term basis than 50, but it may have a negative effect too. It could induce resistance more quickly.
What about side effects and quality of life, intermittent versus continuous, Bob? The patients get a couple weeks off. Do they feel better during that time?
Well, the standard schedule was the 4 weeks on, 2 weeks off, which was originally developed from animal data because the fatigue that was noted was asthenia in animals, and so that it was recognized they needed a break. When the drug went into clinical trials in humans, there was very limited phase one data. It showed a high level of activity, so it was brought very quickly into phase two trials with very limited data on scheduling, and so that's why the 4-2 schedule followed through. For the most part, what happens is patients develop some sort of cumulative toxicity around day 28, and then in a two-week off period, they usually feel better. But the concern has been, is this some sort of an escape medicine and so forth? So that's been the enthusiasm behind the continuation dosing. The continuation dosing, when you actually figure out the dose over a six-week cycle, they're actually getting more drug than the 50 on the 4 weeks on, 2 weeks off. The study that Nick alluded to showed that from that study, it looked like the toxicity patterns were very similar between the 4-2 and the continuation. So I think that's why we really do need the information from this trial so that we can see whether one is better than another.
Right. I never did a lot of the work with intermittent. So when the continuous came available, I was one of the ones who joined that trial. And that has sort of become my standard in my practice is 37.5. I find it to be very well tolerated. But I'm sure it's just simply because historically I didn't learn the 4 week on, 2 week off because my time at Chicago was with sorafenib and I just used continuous sorafenib. Whether that is a negative or a positive, we don't know yet.
I want to go on to, John, your case. You're a 72-year-old lady, but just I want to throw in another question. Actually, that Dave, I'm not sure why you threw this in, maybe you have a patient with this issue. To you, Bob, what about the issue of using an MKI after an acute myocardial infarction, and what do we know in general about the connection to cardiovascular risk?
Well, sunitinib has known acute cardiac toxicity seen in the preclinical models and in the more recent clinical trials in renal cancer and in GIST. It's primarily a decline in ejection fraction. The other cardiac toxicities associated with sunitinib are hypertension and theoretical prolongation of QT syndrome, but that hasn't really been observed in humans. For the most part, in all the studies would not allow a patient in if they had had an acute cardiac event initially within a year, although I think now that has been liberalized somewhat and it's within 6 months. So I think that it depends on the nature of the cardiac event. But I think that within 6 months or a year for acute cardiac event is considered a relative contraindication to using sunitinib.
What about coexisting heart disease, heart failure, et cetera?
With the decline in ejection fraction that's been reported with sunitinib, if a MUGA shows an abnormal ejection fraction, then I think that's a patient that I would consider using sorafenib in as an alternative in first line. I think there was some recent data reported with sorafenib about sorafenib and risk of cardiac toxicity in ESMO. I haven't seen that data yet, but for the most part, that's what I use in my clinical practice. And I think we need to develop more experience, though, with regard to both using sunitinib in the setting of mild cardiac dysfunction and also an assessment of the cardiac dysfunction with some of the other agents that really haven't been explored as thoroughly, like sorafenib or pazopanib.
Dave, anything that prompted you to ask that?
Well, I had a patient that had a history of having two stents, and patients read and then ask those questions, is this a safe drug?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, there's little data. The data that did come out shows with endomyocardial biopsies on sunitinib-treated patients that there is myocardial cell fallout. Again, it's small numbers, and it probably occurs with all the TKIs, although maybe not with pazopanib, but we don't know.
What is pazopanib?
It's a TKI, right? Bob is a bit more aware of the drug than I, but there's a randomized discontinuation trial where the patients were given the drug, and they had a very nice high response rate of 30 or 40, maybe higher percent, and then were randomized to either continue the drug or discontinue the drug. And those who were randomized to discontinue had a pretty rapid progression. So I believe that that study was a registration trial in Europe, and it may actually be on docket to be approved in some European countries fairly soon. And now they're taking it directly head-to-head against sunitinib in the U.S.
I wanted to kind of get some of this background information out, and now we can kind of get more into some of the clinical stuff.